The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Bush stood by and watched the Iraqi army slaughter these populations, killing hundreds of thousands of people. He did impose a no-fly zone that enabled the Kurds in the north of Iraq to recover and begin developing their semi-autonomous region. So then Bush and Clinton imposed the brutal UN sanctions on Iraq after the war, forced it to admit weapons inspectors, and conducted a regular series of bombing runs whenever Saddam Hussein stepped out of line. A minority position at this very moment developed within the Bush administration, in the Papa Bush administration, that would become the Project for the New American Century, all the neocons grouped in the first Bush administration. They said, we actually need regime change. Saddam Hussein should be toppled, and then all the regimes in the Middle East should be toppled, and Quisling regimes, pliant regimes, should be imposed on the region by the United States. But Bush rejected that neocon plan back in the 1990s, and instead, Clinton implemented a policy of what was called dual containment of the two governments that bucked U.S. dictates in the region, Iraq and Iran. So the U.S. had sanctions on both those regimes because they wouldn't obey the demands of the New World Order. To enforce this policy, the U.S. established military bases throughout the Middle East, including in the Holy Lands in Saudi Arabia, something that actually triggered al-Qaeda to turn against the United States, something that had been backed by the United States, now turned against it because of the deployment of U.S. troops to Saudi Arabia. The U.N. estimated that the U.N. sanctions, the U.N. estimated that the U.N. sanctions, that's a mind-bending idea, but the U.N. estimated that those sanctions killed 500,000 children in Iraq during the 1990s. Leslie Stahl confronted Clinton's ethically challenged Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, about this on 60 Minutes. Stahl said, we have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it? And Albright replied, we think the price is worth it. But Clinton's policy of dual containment failed as both Iraq and Iran found ways to skirt the sanctions. The neocons then came to the fore, agitating for a different policy, not containment, but for regime change. And under pressure, Bill Clinton signed the Iraq Liberation Act, which casts the U.S. down the road of the policy of regime change. That begins under the Clinton administration, not just with the Bush administration. The pivot of the neocons' argument was that Iraq was a threat to the U.S. In fact, the opposite was the case. Iraq had been bombed to smithereens, prevented from reconstruction by the sanctions, and its standard of living had been crushed. The weapons inspectors had gotten rid of all the weapons of mass destruction and the capacity of the military to produce any more weapons of mass destruction. In reality, Iraq was a prostrate nation on the verge of collapse, overseen by a tyrant despised by all sections of Iraqi society, the Sunnis, the Shia, and the Kurds. But the U.S. did not care about the social catastrophe they had caused. They had worse things in store for Iraq. Bush II, the younger, the idiot son, came into power and used the pretext of 9/11 to launch a war for regime change in Iraq. His invasion and occupation has sowed the seeds of the sectarianism that is now ripping apart Iraq and the rest of the Middle East. Al-Qaeda's 9/11 terrorist attack in New York City, we have to underscore, was actually reactionary blowback from American imperialism sanctions in Iraq, its oppression of Palestinians, and the troop presence in Saudi Arabia. If you read Osama bin Laden's book, he says all this. He lays it all out. That doesn't justify it, but it explains where it came from. It's blowback that is caused by empire itself. The neocons looked at 9/11 not as a tragedy, but as an opportunity. They actually wrote in their original document in the 1990s that they needed a catalyzing event on the scale of Pearl Harbor to shift the establishment away from containment to a policy of regime change. So they looked upon it, while we were mourning the deaths, they looked upon it as an opportunity to remake the entire Middle East under their auspices. So Bush's started with the invasion of Afghanistan, but that was really a stepping stone to their real target, which was Iraq. If you read the discussions that have been published when 9/11 first happened, they were already talking about Iraq. The neocons were there with a plan. Wolfowitz was like, let's do it. We got to take down Iraq, then go to Iran, then to Syria. We want to impose Quisling regimes throughout the entire region so that we've got control of the oil, And therefore, we can blackmail China and other potential rivals to U.S. domination of the planet. That was their main aim. Their second aim was to bust open OPEC. If you read Michael Schwartz's book, he goes through this in great detail. The U.S. wanted to open up Iraq's oil industry to multinational oil companies, that is, privatize a national state capitalist corporation, open it up to multinationals, increase production of oil in Iraq, and thereby lower the price of oil for American and global capitalism. They wanted to break the OPEC cartel. Bush planned, as I said, to first go after Saddam Hussein and then target which two countries next, right at the center of this crisis, Syria and Iran. Those were the two countries that they targeted for the immediate next regime changes. The neocons famously joked about this. These people are sick. They walk around the State Department, the White House, the Congress, and they tell themselves these kind of jokes. Both Democrats and Republicans, they're equal opportunity in their kind of horrific humor. Anyway, the neocons joked, anyone can go to Baghdad, real men go to Tehran. That's what they had in their sights. They churned out lies, of course, to justify the war. Weapons of mass destruction, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, threat to the United States. As the war would prove, there was no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That would only come into being after the U.S. was in Iraq, formed in response to the U.S. occupation, and they quickly discovered that Iraq was a disaster area that they had created. Nevertheless, the leadership of the Democratic Party signed up for the war, including Hillary Clinton, who made one of her hard decisions and backed Bush's war in Iraq. The media, especially the New York Times, engaged in some of the worst yellow journalism. In fact, basically became a propaganda arm of the American state to win consent for the war in Iraq. And then, of course, Bush ignored the mass international protest movement, one of the largest demonstrations in human history, on February 15th, 2003, when tens of millions of people marched around the world against the impending war. He dismissed it as a focus group. So millions of people, the majority of world public opinion was just a focus group. So Bush bypasses the United Nations and put together a coalition of the willing, they called it, which would be better called a coalition of the bought and bullied, because if you look at the list of people, they're all in debt to the United States. That's where the countries that went along with the war, as well as the lap poodle, Tony Blair in Britain, who volunteered for the job. He so truly believed in his warmongering. So Bush actually believed all his own propaganda. He hoped for a quick war, but he forgot one thing. No nation likes to be occupied. That's the history of empires. Anytime an empire occupies anywhere, people rise up, resist, and fight for their liberation. And that's exactly what happened in Iraq. But they really did believe their own propaganda. So when Bush went in, he thought they were going to be greeted as liberators. People would celebrate. There'd be dancing in the streets. Everybody would love Paul Wolfowitz and Paul Bremer. They even staged propaganda events that are hard to believe, that because these were all broadcast as if they actually happened. The famous toppling of Saddam Hussein's statue was organized by the U.S. military. This was not a spontaneous celebration of the Iraqi population. It was an orchestrated propaganda event that CNN covered live so that everybody saw how happy the Iraqis were. Of course, Iraqis were happy to see Saddam Hussein go. He was a horrible, horrible tyrant that had massacred the populations of Iraq. But none were happy about the U.S. occupation. The Shia population hoped to claim their rights and ability to shape the future of Iraq as the country's majority population. The Sunnis were terrified that they would be punished for their association with Saddam Hussein's regime. Only the Kurds were happy for the U.S. to come in because they expected that this would deliver an independent state in Kurdistan, which is their national right to self-determination. But the U.S. actually opposes that right to self-determination. So even they were grumbling about the consequences of the occupation. So then Bush appointed his viceroy, which I've been joking about, Paul Bremer, and he did everything in his power to piss everybody off. That's essentially what he did. The first thing is he announced that the U.S. was having an occupation, that it wasn't just going to grant democracy to the people of Iraq. And then the second thing he did was privatize everything. He was a neoliberal true believer. They imposed a flat tax in Iraq. If you can imagine that, every fantasy of a Republican troglodyte that you can dream up in the United States, they imposed on Iraq. So they dismantled the state capitalist economy with the promise that suddenly a privatized oil industry would pay for the occupation and everybody would return to the 1970s living standards that Iraqis had enjoyed in the past. Of course, none of this was to materialize. And then the first three pompously called general orders that Bremer issued immediately triggered a mass resistance to the occupation. His first order, called General Order Number 1, fired all members of the Ba'ath Party from their state jobs. Now, it's important to understand that this is the Ba'ath Party, basically, if you wanted a state job, you had to join the Ba'ath Party. So there were hundreds of thousands of people who were teachers, nurses, doctors, who despised Saddam Hussein, but were members of the Ba'ath Party. All these people immediately lost their jobs. So the Sunni population, which was disproportionately the base of the regime, immediately despised the occupation because they immediately were targeted by it. Bremer's second general order dissolved the Iraqi army. This is extremely significant. It was the only institution that held together Kurds, Shia, and Sunni in one formation, especially Shias and Sunnis. Sunnis making up the officer corps and Shia the soldiers. Bremer fired them all. 450,000 people. So the Sunni officers joined the guerrilla resistance and provided it with military leadership. So idiotic decision on Bremer's part. And then the Shia soldiers, the rank and file of the army, joined many of them Muqtada Sadr's resistance movement, the mass protest movement that Sadr led. So then the third general order was that the elections weren't going to happen. And the occupation was going to go on for a while. So immediately all the Shia that expected were finally going to be able to determine the shape of our country based on one person, one vote, was robbed from them. So in one fell swoop with three general orders, the U.S. alienated the entire population of Iraq, mainly its Sunni and Shia components. Triggered a mass guerrilla movement led by Sunni forces, some Islamists, others ex-Ba'athists, tribal leaders. All sorts of forces came into being. There were many, many resistances among the Shia, the Sunni population. And among the Shia population, Muqtada al-Sadr launched a campaign of mass demonstrations demanding elections and an end to the occupation. So now Bush has lost the Iraqi population. Now, the biggest fear was this fractured resistance of Sunnis and Shia would come together as one. That was the biggest fear that the occupiers suddenly confronted. So the Bush administration and Bremer and the rest of them did what empires always do, that is, they turned to a strategy of divide and conquer, to split the resistance and get them to fight amongst themselves. This was a deliberate plan of the Bush administration. First, but before they even got to that, they turned to another thing that alienated the population, that is mass repression of everything that moved. You were arrested, detained, sent to jail in Abu Ghraib, and tortured. And we know the horrific nature of this. If people haven't seen the pictures that Lindy England and her cohorts took in Abu Ghraib and shared as a joke of torture scenes that came to symbolize what the U.S. occupation was really all about. The famous one of a hooded Iraqi man with electrical cords dangling from his hands because they had used those to plug them into wall sockets and batteries and electrify this poor guy. That became the image that replaced the toppled statue as really what the U.S. occupation of Iraq was really all about. So that repression only made people even more angry and fueled the resistance among both the Shia and the Sunni. And then they realized they really had to move on to their strategy of divide and conquer. First, they designed the electoral law to split the population. They used the Lebanese model to apportion seats to design the constitution by sect and ethnicity. So that means you're already communalizing the politics of Iraq. You're turning what was a united population resenting their former state and wanting democracy into a divided, sectarian, and communalist apportionment. Since the majority of the allotment would go to the Shia, the Sunnis saw their impending defeat and boycotted the first elections. So already you have a division between the Sunni and Shia population. The second thing that the Bush administration did was that it exploited the Achilles heel of the Sunni resistance. That is the development for the first time, not before the war, but after the war, of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. These counter-revolutionary bigots targeted the Shia and their religious sites in several attacks, a whole sequence I don't have time to go through, that pissed off, obviously, the Shia population, which went ahead and began to organize their own militias to, first, to stabilize the chaotic conditions that the population, the Shia population, were subject to, given all the privatization and firings and layoffs and confusion of the occupation, but also to defend themselves against these growing Al-Qaeda sectarian attacks on both themselves as people and their religious sites. So what the U.S. did was turn, in this situation, turn to what they called the Salvador option. For people who know what they did in Latin America, they basically incorporated death squads into the Salvadoran regime to do the dirty work of killing and slaughtering anybody who fought for the liberation of the country. That's what they did in Iraq. So the U.S. encouraged Sadr's Mahdi army and the Ishi's Badr brigades to join the security forces and then use them to attack not only Al-Qaeda, not only the guerrilla Sunni resistance, but also the Sunni population itself. As a result, the U.S. directly is responsible for triggering the mass civil war that ripped apart Iraq from 2006 to 2008. The sectarian violence in the country killed 3,000 people a month for 2 years. Think about the conditions that you're living in as a Shia and Sunni person in the main cities. It caused the flight of 2 million refugees to other countries. 2 million more people were internally displaced as people fled ethnically and religiously mixed neighborhoods to religiously segregated and ethnically segregated neighborhoods, further imposing sectarianism as the logic of Iraqi society. All of this is new. There have never been internal divisions of the kind they talk about in the media. This is all Bush's work. This is all his dirty work. Baghdad was transformed from a predominantly Sunni city to a predominantly Shia city. It was around 60-70% Sunni. Now it's flipped to the majority Shia as a result of the civil war. In an effort to put an end to the sectarian bloodshed, Bush did another celebrated thing, his surge of 20,000 troops to Baghdad, with the claim that this would put a lid on the civil war, stabilize the occupation so that they could get back to what they had intended to do in the rest of the Middle East. All of this celebration of the surge is a complete lie. The reality is the civil war had largely burned itself out. The Shia had won the civil war, and the Sunni tribal leadership had decided to call off their attacks on any Shia because they saw their main enemy as actually Al-Qaeda in their own midst, and they developed what were called awakening councils to go after and smash up Al-Qaeda. And then what does Bush do? He says that his troops did it, but really it was the awakening councils. And so Bush put them on the U.S. payroll. He hired the Sunni Awakening Councils onto the U.S. payroll with the promise that he would get Maliki, the new prime minister of Iraq, that the Bush administration handpicked. Think about all the condemnations that are going on in Maliki now. Bush handpicked the guy, canceled other people off from becoming prime minister in this great new democracy, and handpicked Maliki. He promised that he would get Maliki to get to hire all these Sunni Awakening Councils, and of course the Maliki government refused because he was intent on establishing a predominantly Shia state in Iraq. Even when Maliki refused to incorporate the Sunni Awakening Councils, Bush continued to back Maliki, despite his consolidation of this Shia state in Iraq. So by 2008, Bush's imperial agenda is in flames. There's no rolling regime change. The U.S. is bogged down in counterinsurgencies in both Afghanistan and in Iraq. And as a result, the U.S. suffers an incredible, unprecedented relative decline of its imperial power. Compared to what it had aimed to do and what it ended up with, it was a complete catastrophe. Retired General William Olden called Bush's invasion of Iraq the greatest strategic disaster in American history. And he didn't mean of what it did to Iraqis. He meant what it did to the American empire. That's what the strategic disaster for William Olden was. It precipitated the relative decline of American imperialism against the very rivals that it wanted to contain. China in particular, that now is in the ascendancy through the course of the early 2000s, as well as other regional powers, including, ironically, Iran, which had been targeted as the next country for regime change. So Iran actually emerges as the victor of the Iraq War. It gets an ally in the Maliki Shia government in Iraq. to add to Assad in Syria, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Hamas in Palestine. It also secures trade relations, despite the sanctions, with both Russia and China, who become allies of Iran. So with American power in crisis, Bush abandons his plans for regional regime change and instead adopts a balance of power strategy to contain Iran and its so-called Shia Crescent, which was the vocabulary they started to use, which is generalizing the sectarianism they planted in Iraq to the state system in the Middle East. And America's key allies in this new anti-Shia, anti-Iran nexus, this balance of power set of regimes, are Israel and Saudi Arabia. And what did they start clamoring for? War on Iran. You know, the lunatics that run Israel threatening to bomb Iran all the time, and Bush and then Obama trying to restrain the warmongers of Israel. So the Bush administration's plan blows up in their face. They had a plan for rolling regime change to impose an American order and thereby control China in the Middle East. The opposite happened. So the American ruling class said, okay, we gotta fire the chump. We need somebody else who will bid a kinder, gentler face on American imperialism. We got this guy, Barack Obama. He's telegenic. He'll sell to people, the anti-war movement will dissolve, they'll get behind the Democratic Party, and we can get back to business of running the world without opposition. And so they hire Barack Obama and the Democrats to do that job, to rehabilitate the empire. But Obama comes to power in a changed global balance of power. He faces an asymmetric, multipolar world order with the U.S. as a sole superpower, but facing China as a possible rival and a host of regional rivals like Iran. So he retreats to multilateralism to keep the allies on side. Globally, he tries to do the pivot to Asia to contain the rise of China, and a pivot to Central Europe and Eastern Europe to control a reemerging Russia. And in Iraq, Obama essentially continues the policies that George Bush started. The retreat policies, a balance of power, and of supporting the Maliki Shia state, because at this point, they prefer stability to anything else in Iraq, even if it means supporting a sectarian government. So he pressures Maliki over and over again to integrate the Sunnis. Maliki says no and goes about consolidating even further the Shia state. He also tries to pressure Maliki to sign a status of forces agreement that would guarantee legal immunity for U.S. troops. Maliki says no under pressure from Iran because they want a Shia ally. They don't want an integrated state. Iran doesn't. They're a sectarian player in this whole mess as well. So Obama fails, and the U.S. troops scuttle out of the country at the end of 2011 when the last troops leave. The U.S. in the process has wasted $3 million, killed over a million Iraqis, wasted the lives of 4,500 American soldiers, tens of thousands of soldiers who are maimed with PTSD, the victims in our own country, and implants sectarianism, civil war that spreads throughout the Middle East. That's the consequence of the occupation. Freed from this pressure of the occupying force, Maliki quickly moved to purge all his Sunni rivals from the Shia-dominated state. He fires scores of Sunni bureaucrats using the de-Ba'athification law that the U.S. wrote to begin with to fire any Sunni state employees. And then those he couldn't call Ba'athist party members, he accuses of being terrorists and gets rid of them as well. He even charged Iraq's vice president, Tariq al-Hashimi, of terrorism. Hashimi fled the country to exile now in Turkey, and he was convicted by Iraqi courts in absentia and sentenced to death. Maliki then confronts the Kurdish regional government in the north, which had begun to bypass the central government to cut oil deals with Turkey. He also confronted the Kurdish rulers over control of Kirkuk and its oil reserves. So in reaction to Maliki's sectarianism, we begin to see the emergence of a Sunni resistance, a Sunni uprising against the sectarian policies of the Maliki government. And this resistance demands all sorts of things: democracy, right to control of the oil profits so that they can reconstruct their section of the country, which has been devastated and not gotten any of the oil revenues. Maliki responds with brute force, doing exactly what the U.S. did to the insurgency before in Iraq beforehand. Mass sweeps, mass detentions, jailing them in Abu Ghraib, torturing them, trying to get information. And even though Maliki's doing this, Obama awards Maliki a giant new weapons contract of $195 million in weapons to supply the Iraqi army's assault on the Sunni protest movement. This sectarianism that the U.S. had unleashed now in the region now feeds back into Iraq, and this is a key part of understanding the situation. The ruling classes of the region responded to the uprising of the Arab Spring in 2011 with two things: repression and profound sectarianism as a tool to divide and conquer the emergent movement for democracy and end to neoliberalism and liberation of oppressed people in the region. The things that the regional governments do are profoundly disturbing. Obviously, what Saudi Arabia, as one of the epicenters of sectarianism, does, they send their troops into Bahrain to put down a Shia uprising, a mass Shia uprising. And the U.S. turns a blind eye to this repression, because at this point, it's like anything to stabilize the situation. They tried to do a war in Libya to get rid of their sometime ally, sometime opponent, Gaddafi. But at this point, after the disastrous consequences of it, they're like, we need stability. We need this state system, even if it means that they use sectarian and brutal methods to maintain control of the society. The epicenter of the sectarian counter-revolution really becomes Syria. And this is where the connection between Syria and Iraq becomes decisive to understand the immediate crisis that we're now in. The Syrian revolution begins as a nonviolent mass popular uprising, uniting all religious groups against Assad's autocracy and neoliberalism. Assad's state is thoroughly sectarian. It is based on the Alawite minority, whose religion is a branch of Shia Islam, and discriminates against the country's Sunni majority. Assad turns to a strategy of divide and conquer, a sectarian strategy. First, he welcomes the Shia soldiers from Iran and Hezbollah that were supplying arms and troops to crush the Syrian liberation struggle, to crush the Syrian liberation movement. Russia also backs the sectarianism by backing the Assad regime. Second, Assad, and this is the most cynical thing, he releases some of the worst Sunni sectarians from his jails so that they become players in the increasingly militarized struggle. And Assad does this because he hopes that these Sunni sectarians, will attack the Alawite and Christian minorities, thereby consolidating Assad's base as among that population as the protector. He will be the protector against these Sunni terrorist threats. After the disastrous outcome of the Libyan war, the U.S. is reluctant to intervene in Syria. They don't see it as worth a direct military intervention. So the red line gets forgotten by Obama, and instead Obama decides for a Yemeni solution. They want to get rid of Assad, but keep the fundamental structures of the state to repress the situation and to maintain stability in the region. So the U.S. only gives minimal support to what they call the moderate Syrian guerrillas. And this is where other players in the region become decisive. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Qatar fund the Sunni extremists, the Islamists, and the bourgeoisie, the really reactionary bourgeoisie in these countries, fund directly Al-Qaeda and the emerging formation called ISIS. ISIS, now I'll get to explain ISIS. ISIS regrouped from the splintered forces of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's where this group really finds its emergence. But they don't regroup in Iraq, where they've been crushed by the awakening councils, by the Sunni tribal leadership. They regroup in Syria, originally as part of the Al-Nusra Front, which is Al-Qaeda's organization in Syria. But they split from Al-Nusra over a disagreement over strategy. Al-Nusra is advocating terrorist attacks against the Assad regime in Syria. ISIS has a different goal. They want to set up a Sunni caliphate that stretches across Syria and Iraq based in the Sunni population. And so they actually don't confront Assad's regime. All this discussion that they're part of the civil war in Syria is not true. ISIS does not fight Assad. In fact, ISIS, once it got control of a couple of towns in Syria and got control of their oil, actually cut oil deals with Assad's regime. And Assad doesn't target them. In fact, what ISIS begins to do is fight the rest of the forces in the resistance movement against Syria. So they are not, they're counter-revolutionaries in every sense in Syria. And as a result of their different strategy, they set up all these towns, they get control of oil, and they begin to acquire not only troops, which they have about 15,000 of, they're quite small, but they also get a lot of money, they get oil revenues, and they set up a taxation system. They are setting up an incipient state. That's what they're really about. And they become quite wealthy. They're estimated to have around, you know, nothing compared to the United States, which is like whatever, godzillion amount of dollars. But they have a war chest of around $2 billion that they got a lot more of once they went into Mosul, because they got $500 million when they broke open the bank in Mosul. So they start to becoming a serious player in the situation. So they build this base in Syria, and then they stretch back into Iraq, where they strike a deal with the ex-Ba'athists in an organization called the Naqshbandi Order, as well as the Awakening Councils led by the tribal leaders. They establish this alliance, and then they begin to conquer territory within Iraq. First in Fallujah, then in Ramadi, and then their seizure that we've just gone through of Mosul. And the stunning thing about this is that it connects with a deep mass Sunni opposition to the Shia state, but the Sunni population does not support ISIS. They see ISIS as a lesser evil compared to the sectarian oppression they were facing under the Maliki regime. So ISIS goes in with 1,200 fighters into Mosul, and the Iraqi army evaporates. They just disappear. 30,000 troops flee Mosul, and then ISIS conquers all the way to Tikrit in the south. They go all the way to the Syrian border and get border towns on the border between Syria and Iraq. They've gone to the border of Jordan. They've gone to the border of Saudi Arabia, and they're pushing north toward Kurdish territories as well. And the alliance they've struck with the Ba'athists and with the tribal council leadership means that they've got an incipient state that stretches across these two countries. And the other final thing that's important is that it looks like they've gotten control of the oil refinery in Baji, which means that they've got an ability to have an oil-based state of their own to compete with the Kurdish one in the north and the Shia one in the south. The reaction of the other players in Iraq shows how close we are to an even more frightening civil war. The Kurdish regional government has seized control of Kirkuk and its oil reserves. They've mobilized their Peshmerga militia of around 100,000 to police their border with ISIS-controlled territories. And they're increasingly hinting, basically they're saying back-channel negotiations with Turkey and the United States to declare an independent Kurdish state. Which is their national right to do so, and it would be a liberation. We'll see if they sell out their sisters and brothers in Syria, Iran, and Turkey, because there may be a nasty deal that they cut that doesn't actually win national liberation for the entire oppressed nation of Kurdistan. So that's what the Kurds have done in the north. Maliki's Shia state has been shown to be weak, utterly unpopular, sectarian, uneven, unable to enforce its rule with its military. So Maliki's Dawa party, even though it did win most of the seats in April's parliamentary elections, those votes were solely based on Shia, the Shia population, and they didn't have enough seats to form a government. So this is a rump government that does not have a popular base and an ability to enforce its order. Especially given that the military is in a state of collapse. So in desperation, Maliki has turned to his former competitors, Sadr and Ishi, and asked them to mobilize their militias to confront ISIS. The Shia cleric Ayatollah al-Sistani called for Iraqis, not just Shia, to join the defense of the nation against ISIS, but in reality, only Shia have responded, and they've responded in mass numbers. Tens of thousands of Shia have mobilized to join the militias. So this time, a civil war could be far worse. The Sunnis are much more organized, have an incipient state, and have a serious fighting force. The Kurds to the north have their own fighting force in the Peshmerga. The Shia in the south, with backed up with these militias, are seriously armed and organized as well. So any conflict this time will be far more militarized and far more dangerous. All the regional powers have responded to the chaos in Iraq. Iran has sent Soleimani and the 2,000 special forces to defend the Shia state. Turkey has supported the forces fighting Assad and opposes the Shia state in Iraq, but is very worried about the Kurds declaring an independent state in the north. They would prefer to keep Iraq together as a unitary state. Syria, which has ignored the crisis, is now worried that that ISIS has become a threat and has launched these airstrikes on ISIS. Jordan is worried about the growing sectarian conflict impacting the huge Iraqi and Syrian refugee population that lives in Jordan. Israel has bombed targets in Syria and is worried about any collaboration between the U.S. and Iran to stabilize Iraq. They still want war against Iran. If you listen to Netanyahu, he just continues to rave daily. Israel has also taken advantage of this crisis to launch attacks into Palestine, into the occupied territories. Saudi Arabia, which has been happy to see Assad and Maliki go down, are now worried that ISIS, like Osama bin Laden before him, will challenge their regime. ISIS actually considers the Saudi Wahhabist regime as apostates, to get a sense of how reactionary the ISIS forces are. The entire state system, really, that the British and French set up at the end of World War I through the secret treaties of Sykes and Picot are now at risk. All the borders have been destabilized. And ISIS actually explicitly states this as their goal, to smash Sykes-Picot. If you read their internal communiques, they want to overthrow Sykes-Picot and establish a new Sunni caliphate throughout the Middle East. So this is an enormous crisis for American imperialism, and I'll wrap up with this. Obama wanted to put the disastrous occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan behind him and move on to the pivot to Asia and the containment of Putin in Russia. But the crisis has compelled the U.S. to act, but it has no clear strategy whatsoever. Its balance of power strategy has produced bewildering contradictions that can only inflame the situation. Just think about who their alliances are right now. It's in an alliance with Iran to stabilize Iraq. It's in an alliance with Saudi Arabia and Israel against Iran to destroy their nuclear program. Just get your head around that by itself. The American collaboration with Iran enrages Israel, Saudi Arabia, as well as Turkey. U.S. imperialism's relative decline means that any large-scale intervention by the U.S. is, for now, out of the question, I think. Thus, McCain, Bremer, and Cheney are really out of their minds. This call for an invasion is crazy talk. I think that's electioneering, but who knows, they might even believe their own, they believe a lot of stuff, so they might believe this stuff too. Obama's preferred policy is to hold Iraq together through political reconciliation. So he sent Secretary of State John Kerry, who joined Bush really as one of the global village idiots, to try and get all the forces in Iraq to agree to political reconciliation. So that's what Kerry was sent to do. That is, they want to get rid of Maliki and have political reconciliation between the Sunnis, Kurds, and Shia in Iraq. That's the first goal. And that's the condition, really, for getting the military aid, the surveillance, et cetera, that the Obama administration has promised. So it's hard to see how political reconciliation would actually happen, given what I've described. The only advantage the U.S. actually has is ISIS itself, because ISIS in the past, when it was al-Qaeda, so alienated the Sunni tribal leadership and ex-Ba'athists that they were willing to cut a deal with the Shia forces, the Shia ruling class, and the Kurdish ruling class to keep a unitary state together. But this time, I think we've crossed the Rubicon with that. I think it's a different scenario. Thus, Obama's fallback strategy is actually accepting the partition of the country. But the destabilizing impact of that partition would ripple through the entire region. So that's not really much of a solution. So like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, the U.S. has conjured up a metastasizing crisis which it cannot control or resolve. The hope amidst this horror is the revolutionary process of the Arab Spring. That mass uprising of the oppressed and exploited is the only hope of overcoming the toxic combination of imperialism, autocracy, neoliberalism, and sectarianism that the U.S. introduced into the Middle East. At its peak of the struggle of the Arab Spring, the masses of people in the revolutionary wing called for overcoming the sectarian divisions, uniting in Egypt the Coptic Christian minority with the Muslim majority in the population against any kind of divide and rule strategy. The Syrian revolution put forward a similar kind of demand. But the forces of the left and the class forces are not yet organized and politically conscious enough to fight for that kind of demand. So in this counter-revolutionary phase of the Arab Spring, the left will have to do the hard work in the Middle East and in these strategic countries to rebuild itself and the class forces to raise these kinds of demands, because no state in the region has a solution to this crisis. In reality, the only thing that will solve this deep crisis is the emergence of a working class movement throughout the region with socialist leadership that can fight for a united socialist federation in the Middle East. That's the only way we are going to rip up the roots of the current crisis. Here at home, we have an enormous task. We have to educate people. Lots of people are bewildered by events in the Middle East. We have to do work of panels and education, reading, discussion, so that we arm a whole new generation of activists to understand this situation and to realize that the U.S. is responsible. The U.S. government introduced this catastrophe into the Middle East. Everything it does will not solve this. It will make it worse, it may delay it, but it keeps the whole order set up that is responsible for this disaster that we're seeing unfold. The second thing we need to do is confront the campism that is developed on the left, where different sections of the left say, I like that state, I like that state, I like that state. Some like Russia, some like Iran, some grotesquely like Assad's dictatorship in Syria. We have to say that kind of garbage should not pass for the left. We stand for international struggle for liberation from below. In all the countries of the Middle East and here at home. The main enemy is at home. We have to fight our own imperialism, but we never should support another rival imperialism or another capitalist state. We are for the liberation of humanity from below. We have a task, like the revolutionaries in the Middle East, of having, of building that kind of movement. We have that task here in the United States.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.